whose sanctions have failed to undermine the steady march of the Iranian nations towards the pinnacle of progress. Named Zuljanah, literally the two-winged, in honor of the famous horse of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, which he had given to his younger grandson Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the immortal martyr of Karbala, the satellite carrier uses solid fuel technology and is the most powerful engine so far, comparable to any such thing produced by the big powers. According to experts, it uses solid fuel in its first two stages of launch and liquid fuel in the third. It can carry a satellite weighing up to 220 kilograms for 500 kilometers and speaks of the power and determination of Islamic Iran to master the latest in science and technology. This was not a solitary step in this field by Iran, which over the past four decades, in spite of the hurdles placed in its way by the U.S., has continued to explore new vistas of scientific achievements that were unthinkable before the victory of Islamic Revolution. For a country whose experts have found the effective antidote to the coronavirus pandemic, and are on the threshold of mass manufacture of this vaccine, no field of modern science is beyond their grasp. True to the vision of that great Gnostic and jurisprudent, the father of Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who, as part of his emphasis on adherence of the nation to the genuine teachings of Islam, stressed development of science and knowledge, Iranian Muslims have proven their caliber to the whole world thanks to their political, cultural, economic, and intellectual independence. Today, the concept of national self-esteem and return to the self has transformed Iran into a solid industrial base. In medicine, in nuclear energy, in nanotechnology, in the defense fields, in the production of missiles, in aerospace, in cyberspace, and in the various spheres of heavy industries, the Islamic Republic of Iran has made giant strides to the amazement of the world. This has unnerved the West and its cowardly clients, especially the illegal Zionist entity, which despite the nuclear armaments it has produced, it is worried that the grand display of people's power by Iran has inspired the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Yemenis, and other oppressed people to solidify the ranks of the axis of resistance. In other words, this awakening in the region, which the Zionists and the Americans have failed to dampen despite the supply of state-of-the-art military hardware to their clients, will soon liberate Palestine by wiping out Israel from the map of West Asia region, not necessarily through war. As noted by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, if the UN really believes in democracy and the birthrights of nations, it should organize a referendum to resolve once and for all the chronic question of the illegal occupation of Palestine by the Zionists of Europe since 1948. In the meantime, Iran, which has ruled out the manufacture of weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear, is proud to proclaim that its peaceful scientific growth is greater than that of many advanced countries, and it will certainly share these achievements with the legal governments and popular movements for the independence of the whole region from the hegemony of the United States of America.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, mutual rights. Rights and duties always go hand in hand, and greater rights call for greater duty and responsibility. The Holy Quran places heavy emphasis on duty to one's parents. We all know that parents have a special status in Islam, a special rank in Islam, and they're supposed to be respected and their rights need to be fulfilled. Now, while parents enjoy great rights vis-a-vis their children, they also bear a heavy responsibility to this. They shall at no time neglect to train their children to help them improve physically, like bodily in terms of their physique, as well as spirituality, and to keep them away from mental and moral taints. This is, what parents are expected to do towards their child. Now, Children have their own duties towards the parents, but parents are not off the hook. Sometimes, you know, in our societies, parents seem to think that, okay, you know, our responsibility was to just give birth to this baby and then, you know, grow them up to like, you know, a few years of their age, and then they're on their own. Well, guess what? This is not the Islamic approach. Being a parent, you have to fulfill your duties for the rest of your life. You can't just, you know, say that, okay, your duty was just to initially bring the baby to the world and feed them. No, there are a lot more duties that Islam expects you to take care of, because Islam is after building a society that is a balanced society, that is a healthy society, and you are a contributor to that society through your children and through yourself, of course. So this is, you know, something to remember, that not only that parents have rights, but children have their own rights as well. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the mutual rights. And while it is commonly discussed what the rights of parents are, many a times it is neglected that the children have their rights too. So children are supposed to take care of their parents the way Islam expects them to and fulfill their rights. And similarly, parents need to fulfill the rights of the children as Islam expects them to do. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, in the same way as the children are to be held to account for disrespecting and disregarding parents' rights, parents are also accountable for not observing the rights of their children. This is the hadith of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, when it comes to the nourishment of children, remember there are two aspects that parents are responsible for. Predominantly at a macro level, there are two aspects. One is the physical nourishment that includes their mental nourishment. And then the second one is the spiritual nourishment. They both are equally important. In today's time and age where we live, you know, in a materialistic era, you can say, unfortunately, many parents are paying attention towards the physical nourishment, the mental nourishment of their children. But very few are thinking of the spiritual nourishment. They both are equally important. And one may argue that the spiritual nourishment is more important than the physical nourishment. Because at the end of the day, physically, everybody grows. They end up eating something, they end up taking care of their health, and they turn out to be fine individuals. But spiritually, it takes extra effort to make that happen. So remember, parents, all the parents out there listening to us right now, your children have rights upon your neck. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks in his first foreign policy speech included a handful of announcements and intentions, including Washington's decision to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia in order to avoid the current humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen to be worsened. Biden condemned the Saudi-led war on Yemen, saying it has created a humanitarian and a strategic catastrophe, and it has to end. Indeed, 6 years of war and blockade in Yemen has taken a heavy toll on the country. Thousands have lost their lives in the Saudi-led attacks, while millions lost their homes or abandoned them to run away from the horrors of war. But the degree which the U.S. was involved was confirmed by a New York Times article, facts that were not well known up to this point. The article stated that Saudi F-15 jets were not only serviced by American mechanics, but also American technicians upgraded the targeting software and other classified technology. Saudi commanders sat with American military officials who provided intelligence and tactical advice, which included dropping American bombs. UNICEF has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 24 million in dire need of help. Washington has been the biggest arms supplier of Riyadh during the first 5 years of Yemen war, as it provided three-quarters of Saudi's arms imports. For Washington, halting arms sales to Riyadh is not a cost-effective decision, even though Biden has promised to do so. It appears that Biden is using a double standard policy. He claims he wants to end the Yemen war and stop selling arms to Riyadh, which means losing billions of dollars of income. Contrastingly, he promises to provide defensive support for Saudi Arabia to defend itself against Yemeni attacks. The Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to Biden's speech, saying that Yemenis do not trust Washington's words on ending the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Ansarullah also says the establishment of real peace in the war-hit country is only possible if the Saudi-led attacks and blockade end, signaling that Yemen seeks real action to solve the problem, not just words. Despite Joe Biden's show of reversing former U.S. President Donald Trump's foreign policy, it seems Biden is using a hypocritical policy in dealing with Yemen war.
Well, the situation in terms of Saudi Arabia and the war against Yemen has been going on now for several years. I don't think the Biden position is really any different, essentially, from the point of view of the Yemeni people who have been suffering. We have to remember, of course, this kind of terminology that's used about military hardware being used for defensive capabilities. No military hardware is made for defensive capabilities if it's being used against a population as we've seen in the Yemen. So I don't anticipate there's going to be that much of a difference in terms of this policy decision from the point of view of whether the United States is supporting the Saudi regime or not.
In his first foreign policy speech, the U.S. President Joe Biden indicated that his administration will deal with Russia differently, saying the time of the U.S. rolling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions, including election interference and cyber attacks, is over, and that Washington will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia. The U.S. president made it clear that Washington is keen on pushing back Russian threats and human rights abuse. Biden also condemned detention of the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and called for his immediate release. He also urged Moscow to hold using force against opposition protests. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while the Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. It also backed police actions against what it calls unauthorized rallies. Biden made those remarks while his administration moved quickly to extend the New START arms control treaty with Russia. The extension of this landmark arms control treaty will limit the number of nuclear missiles and warheads each country can deploy. But how could Moscow and Washington reach this agreement despite their disagreements?
Their concern is China rather than Russia. For the United States, the situation in Russia is a bit of a sideshow. They're not really sure what's happening on the ground. We know there are elements from the United States who are trying to destabilize Russia as we speak, and the situation with Navalny is very fluid indeed. So I think the Russians are, in a sense, going about their business, and the Americans are waiting in the wings to see what happens. So I think really in terms of geopolitics, the Biden administration is much more concerned with China as a superpower, as what it would define as a challenge to US hegemony. And I think with the situation in Russia, United States will be playing both sides of the game.
While the U.S. President Joe Biden claimed his administration policy to deal with Russia's foreign policy is head-on, Biden has shown a double-standard approach. On one hand, he denounces Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny's arrest, but on a wider scale, he rushes to reach an accord with Kremlin. With this hypocrisy in Washington's foreign policy, where does Biden's policy with Russia lie?
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to a sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties. But Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the center-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Center-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved its attack of forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel, and drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eklima Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, and most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello and welcome back to the light. A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around north of America, to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, round Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America, and I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rathwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at that time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Some might say pandas are natural born celebrities, and they are right. In China, Sichuan province, 10 panda cubs have made their first public debut, with throngs of journalists and photographers watching their every move. All of the adorable creatures, which are not named yet, were born in 2020 at the Wolong Conservation and Research Center. Their age ranges from just 120 to 190 days. Each of the cubs has a weight of about 10 kilograms. Over the past year, a total of 44 panda cubs were born around the globe.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs, and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading on the bridges, buildings, and squares. The organizers have planned 2 routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
An American artist has committed himself to drawing 50,000 bees on buildings around the world. Matthew Willey, who has painted murals for 25 years, came up with the idea after a bee buzzed into his room. His goal is to raise awareness about saving the little fuzzy insects. 50,000 is the number of bees in a healthy, thriving hive in nature. During the past 5 years, Willey has painted over 5,500 of the insects in 30 murals.
My goal has always been to be in every type of neighborhood in the world. So that would be all of the continents, all of, you know, I can't literally paint bees in every community, but to take a cross section and say, you know, in every type of place, these bees have been painted, because I'm really, even though it is a healthy hive of bees that visually will be painted, it's really us. I'm painting the human race into this collective hive.
Willey says many people have so far supported his project with their donations. He hopes that his murals prompt people to rethink their relationship with nature. Bees and other insects are constantly facing a range of threats, from the use of pesticides to habitat loss and climate change. 79-year-old Siberian grandmother ice skates on frozen Lake Baikal to look after her cows, or just to have some fun. Lobosh of Morkhodova has lived alone by the world's oldest and deepest lake since her husband died in 2011. Her daily routine consists of chopping wood and carrying buckets of water from an ice hole, keeping cows and regularly hitting the ice. Lubushov uses a pair of steel skates made by her father 76 years ago to check on her cows when they walk too far from her house. When asked why she likes skating, the babushka said because her heart longs for it.
I need my skates for various things. I need them to run errands and I need them for fun, to have a skate or to look for my cows. I can ice skate here and there when walking through the snow is hard. I skate to a direction looking for my cows. And when I see they're not there, I skate to another part and find them roaming there. I call them and they return home, just like that. And without chores, when I just want to ice skate, I can do it.
Even the strong winds, unrelenting cold, and constant hard work don't deter Lubozhosh Morkhodova, whose name translates as love walking on the sea. Since her husband's death, she has been resisting calls from her family to move back to the city. Lake Baikal is often frozen over for half of the year, and the septuagenarian believes skating on it is the secret to her longevity.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today and these days mark the anniversary of the victory of Islam after an era of darkness covering the entirety of the earth. These days are the days that the light of the Ahlul Bayt, the light of the Imam of our time, started to shine on the earth again through the revolution of the Ahlul Bayt, the Islamic revolution, and establishing in one part of the world, starting in that part of the world, the Islamic government, the government of the 12th Imam Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, when He gives a blessing, then with it comes responsibilities. There's rizq that's coming to us through the revolution. Real Islam, true Islam, all these are rizq from Allah. Kulu, take it, wala tatghaw. Don't disobey. Don't rebel. What are we supposed to do? We've got to support it by openly being in support of that government, saying this is our government, saying this is an Islamic government, saying that we are under the leadership. This is our responsibility. This is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from us today. Let me explain a little bit why that is our responsibility in light of the future and the past. What's the future? The future is this revolution encompassing the globe. Eventually it will. That's what we have from our ahadith. It's been foretold. We have been told about this. This was the beginning of the revolution of the Imam of our time. This is very clear. Anyone who does a little bit of research and think about it and put the ahadith and verses together, it's very clear. So this is going to, that's the future. The past, how did this happen? How did the revolution happen? The revolution did not happen because there were armed groups fighting the regime. That was not what brought the regime to its knees. The regime of the Shah to its knees. That didn't. Read the history of the revolution. Imam Khomeini did not tell some of those groups that were really believers and they were mujahideen who were fighting the system and they were taking out some major figures from the Shah's regime. They had supplied themselves and trained themselves with arms, and they took out certain figures. Imam Khomeini didn't tell them what you're doing is haram, but Imam Khomeini didn't encourage that. That's not what he did. I'm not going, you guys do whatever you think is right, that's your thing. But that wasn't what brought the regime to its knees. When Imam Khomeini started, he didn't say go out and kill the police or go out put bombs here and there. He didn't do any of that. He addressed the Shah and he said, what you're doing is wrong, and people know that what is happening is wrong, and we should stand for Islam, stand for Allah. That's what he said. People came out next day on the streets in Qom and in Varamin, close to Tehran, a smaller town close to Tehran. People came out with their kafans. They were killed. Imam Khomeini was in prison. Imam Khomeini continued speaking. People coming out, some of them killed, some of them in prison. Imam Khomeini continued speaking. The numbers of supporters of this ideology, this belief in Iran started to grow. A year before the revolution succeeded, because of this work, when Imam Khomeini's son passed or he was assassinated, and they started holding big programs in Iran, the Shah had an article written to disrespect Imam Khomeini. The article was published. The people of Qom came out in large numbers against the Shah. That's all they did. Again, they didn't bomb anywhere, they didn't pull out arms, they didn't do that. They came out on the streets in large numbers against the Shah and against his command and against that cartoon and against that article that was published in that newspaper. The Shah came, cracked down on them, killed a number of them. News got out. The people of Tabriz and other cities, but the largest one was the people of Tabriz. 40 days later, on the Arba'in of the Shuhada, they learned from Imam al-Hussein's family, Arba'in, holding Arba'in of Shuhada, When you're in a movement against a tyranny, they held the Arba'in in Tabriz. People in Tabriz were killed. The Arba'in of the Shuhada of Tabriz was held in multiple cities. The largest congregations and the largest crackdown was in Yazd, another major city in Iran. Then it continued, and then day after day, it started picking up more and more momentum. In what way? Support of the people coming out. Imam Khomeini telling them, you need to come out and support and chant against the Shah. In Muharram, the Muharram programs, while Imam al-Hussein's name is mentioned, connecting it to that day, connecting it to their time, and connecting Yazid to their time. And so all those processions of Muharram were the largest processions against the Shah. And they killed them, but they continued coming. Again, bombing, guns, no. What support? Showing that support, coming out on the streets when it was needed to come out on the streets. When Imam Khomeini told them, we need to shut down industries in Iran, the workers shut down. When they supported, they didn't say we're going to come out in arms. Imam Khomeini said, the workers, the oil company workers, they shut down the oil company facilities, and so oil was not being exported. The car industry companies, the workers did not go to work. Other businesses, some for 50 days, they shut down their business for 50 days, 2 months almost, until Imam Khomeini came and the revolution succeeded. Support in these ways. People need to join. In the early days, the numbers of people were small, and the Shah thought there's no threat here. Or when he felt the threat, exile. They tried to sentence Imam Khomeini to death. Again, the people supported, ulama supported. They couldn't do that. They sent him to exile. Thought they could get rid of that. Imam Khomeini continued. People started supporting more and more. The numbers of people started supporting. The level of support increased. And the revolution succeeded. The global revolution needs the same thing. The global revolution needs the exact same thing, the exact same pattern.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.